Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along to the Gallipoli Club tonight, where Carolyn Overington makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. Many of you here know her well. She's an award-winning journalist and author. She has six best-selling novels to her name and three works of non-fiction. And she has twice won Australia's most prestigious journalism award, the Walkley, and has been awarded the Blake Dawson Prize for Business Writing. And formerly with the Australian, and Carolyn Overington is now Associate Editor at the Australian Women's Weekly. And she lives in Sydney, and she's here tonight at the Sydney Institute to talk on the occasion of the release of her most recent book, The Last Woman Hanged, The Terrible True Story of Louisa Collins. Carolyn Overington, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Hello and welcome. Thank you, Anne and Gerard, for hosting me tonight. Thank you in particular to the descendants of Louisa Collins, many of whom are here tonight, and to the descendants of several other of the characters in the book who are also with us. It has long been my tradition to start a presentation by making a little joke. And so I looked around for something funny that I could say about men, women, and poison. And it turns out they go quite well together. Perhaps the most famous exchange on the subject took place between the British Prime Minister, Winston Churchill, and Lady Nancy Astor. For those who don't know, Lady Nancy was the first woman to take her seat in the House of Commons in London. She wasn't a very pleasant woman. She was twice married and once divorced. And she used to say of her husband, "I married beneath me, but then most women do." Legend has it that Churchill found himself seated next to Nancy at a dinner and he wasn't entirely thrilled. At some point they had an argument. And she said, if you were my husband, I'd poison your tea. And he replied, if I was your husband, I'd drink it. Louisa Collins was accused of murdering her husband with an arsenic poison. And she was convicted and became both the first and the last woman to be hanged at the Darlinghurst jail. I should say at the outset that I realise that Louisa's name is probably not familiar to all of you. You know the names perhaps of Australia's most famous bushrangers. You know about the gold rush. You know about Captain Cook. You know about Bennelong. These characters are at the heart of some of Australia's most enduring legends. And yet you may never have heard of Louisa Collins. And that for me is astonishing, because she is one of the only people in the world ever to be tried not once, not twice, but four times for the crime of murder. It is entirely possible that she was innocent. And at the very least, I think I can persuade you tonight that the case against Louisa was not proved. I came across Louisa's case quite by chance. I was working on a different murder trial for the Australian newspaper. There had been a mistrial, and so one of the editors asked me to find out, had anybody ever been tried more than twice for murder? I had a look at the archives, and I came upon Louisa's case. She hadn't been tried twice. She had been tried four times before the Crown managed to get their conviction. And the case began to trouble me. How compelling could the evidence really be? Who in the annals of English law had ever had to face four trials before their execution? And so I went looking for the original forensic reports. I didn't really believe that I would find them, but there they were, stored in old and dusty boxes at New South Wales State Records, which is in turn a cool building under the gum trees in Sydney's west. Those records are more than 120 years old now, but they had been preserved, as had some of Louise's letters from jail, in which she begs for her life. From there I went looking for the records from the old Supreme Court, and for whatever notes may have been taken by police, and for the old witness statements from people who lived in Louise's street. And some of the evidence is very strongly suggestive of Louise's guilt. But I had some nagging doubts. The case was full of strange ticks and annoying coincidences. And before long, some of the characters, including the ghastly hangman, had begun to haunt my dreams. I had to know more about this woman. I had to find out what they had done to her and why. So who was she? Louisa was born at a place called Belltrees, near Scone. It was then, and is now, the home of the White family. Her father was an ex-convict. Her mother was a free settler. She was one of about 10 children. She was trained as a domestic, and at age 14, she took a position in Merriwa. She was a pretty little girl who became a terrible flirt. There was a newspaper report in one of the Merriwa's local newspapers which said that at some point she had the attention of every young man in the village. But her mother decided that she should marry the local butcher. And so she did. She stayed married to Charles Andrews for more than 20 years, and she gave birth to 9 of his children, 7 of whom survived infancy. Then in 1886, when Louisa was living in Botany, her first husband, Charles, died. A short time later, she remarried. But that second husband was pretty soon dead too. With 2 husbands dead in less than 14 months, the authorities decided that it could not possibly be an accident. She must have poisoned them. And so in 1888, the centenary year here in New South Wales, she was placed on trial. The first trial was for the murder of her second husband, Michael Collins. After Louisa had married Charles and Charles had died, Louisa had married a man who was almost 10 years younger than she was and very, very handsome. And there is no doubt in my mind that she was madly in love with him. The first jury failed to convict, and so they tried her again. When that failed, they changed tack and they tried her for the murder of her first husband. When that failed, they went back to the first husband and tried her again. And this time they got a conviction. Louisa was sentenced to hang. The first question that this book, Last Woman Hanged, seeks to answer is, did she do it? Did Louisa deserve to be taken to the gallows? All the evidence in the case is circumstantial. This isn't one of those cases where there is a bloody axe or a knife or a gun. Nobody saw her do it. The Crown had to build its case without so much as a single eyewitness. The Crown also had to come up with a motive. Why would Louisa kill her first husband? Well, they decided, perhaps she was sick of him. She only married him because her mother made the match, and as a husband, he bored her to tears. She liked to drink. He didn't. She liked to dance. He didn't. And Louisa had, by the end of her marriage, fallen in love with another man. She was in love with Michael Collins. And there was no way she could simply get a divorce. Divorce was hard to get. And women in the 19th century often lost their children when they divorced their husbands. So perhaps she wanted to get rid of her first husband so she could marry Michael, which is all very well. But Louisa Collins was never convicted of the murder of her first husband. They tried her for that crime, and they failed. Louisa was sentenced to hang for the murder of her second husband, Michael, the much younger, much more handsome, second man in her life, the man that she absolutely loved. So why kill him? Well, the Crown said, perhaps she got sick of him too. Maybe. But is there no other explanation for Michael's death? I spent a good deal of time reading through the original notes taken at the autopsy. The post-mortem, I would make clear, leaves me in no doubt that Michael Collins was poisoned. His insides were red raw. His stomach, his kidneys, even his rectum were terribly inflamed. He spent the last few weeks of his life vomiting and spitting. He was rotting from the inside out. So he was poisoned. But where did the poison come from? The Crown case was simply this. Louisa gave it to him. But how did they know that? Some of the strongest evidence against Louisa came from her only daughter, a 10-year-old girl whose name was May. They asked her to take a Bible in her hand, appear in front of her mother in the central court in Darlinghurst, and testify. She was required to say that she had seen a box of poison in their house, poison that was known as Rough on Rats. Rough on Rats was not an Australian invention. It came to Australia from the United States. A man who went by the initials of E.S., E.S. Wells, had come home from the Civil War. He was hungry. He woke one morning and found that rats had eaten his entire store of bread. He swore vengeance, and he concocted a poison to take care of the rat problem in the United States. Rough on Rats was soon for sale in all of the Australian colonies and all around the world. Louisa Collins probably did have a box of Rough on Rats in her house. Most people who lived in Sydney did. May stood up and told the judge that yes, she had seen this box. When they asked her what was in it, she said it was Rough on Rats. And when they asked her, how do you know? She said, because I can read. And she spelt the letters out for the jurors in the courtroom. The emotion of the moment was captured by Sydney's newspapers, which said, in giving evidence against her mother, the pretty child, named May, was very much affected. The prisoner, being Louisa, and many of the jurors, felt the situation keenly. Louisa herself wrote her heartbreak at having to listen to May give the evidence that would condemn her mother to the gallows. She said, my heart and soul is wrapped up in that girl. I see her and I hear her made to take the witness box and say sufficient to send her own mother to the gallows. Little May was described in court as a pretty girl and as a clever girl, and she told the judge absolutely that she had seen the poison in the house. It wasn't much, but combined with the statements from police and from reliable neighbours, from doctors and from others, it was enough. The jury convicted. And the Chief Justice, Sir Frederick Darling, sentenced Louisa to hang. And hang she did. But was there another explanation for the poison that we know was in Michael's system? In fact, there are two and possibly three plausible scenarios. One is perhaps that somebody else gave the poison to Michael. A rival, a neighbour, a child, one of the six children who lived in the house. It's not likely, but it's possible. He hadn't been in Sydney for very long. We don't know what enemies he had. But much more likely is this. Both of Louisa's husbands, Michael and Charles, were wool washers. As many of you here today probably already know, if you worked with sheep and wool in the 19th century, you worked with arsenic. Sheep were regularly and commonly treated with arsenic and dipped in arsenic to kill the ticks and remove the grit. And on the day that he first became sick, Michael had been riding around Sydney all day with an open wound on his leg on a dray that was covered with wet skins. The open weeping sore on Michael's leg, he said he had treated with a paste. It was not uncommon in the 19th century to use a paste that contained arsenic. It stopped the smell from rising, which meant it stopped gangrene from settling in. Then, too, there is the fact that at the time of his death, Michael was himself taking a range of different potions. Louisa had, in fact, spent the last weeks of her life running to the doctor or sending her children to the pharmacist to beg for help. Several times, she purchased a number of potions which were subsequently given to Michael or which Michael took. It wasn't uncommon in the 19th century for pharmacists to include arsenic in their products. One potion in particular, bismuth, has arsenic as a byproduct, and in the body, bismuth behaves like arsenic. I understand that some people will say to me, well, you're a little soft in the head. Of course she did it. All I'm saying is the case was not proved beyond a reasonable doubt, and I'm not out here on a limb here, because three juries agree with me. They declined to convict her. So that is the first point of this book, to re-examine the evidence. But of course, all evidence must be read in its historical context. Louisa Collins died at a time when women were in no sense equal under the law, except when it came to the gallows. Women could not vote. They could not sit in Parliament. There were no women judges, and there were no women jurors either. Louisa was tried before four juries of 48 men. All of the judges were men, the lawyers were men, as was the governor, as was the premier. Any of these men at any time could have stopped the hanging. They declined to do so. And in their absence, it fell to women to find the moral courage to try to save this woman's life. One of the pleasures in writing this book was in discovering the names, and in some cases, even the faces of some of the women who rose up to fight for Louisa. It's true that their tenacity did not save her. She was hanged, but it did ultimately carry women from their homes all the way to Parliament House. Less than 15 years after Louisa was hanged, Australian women would become some of the first in the world to get the vote. They took their seats in State Parliament and in Canberra. They became doctors and lawyers and judges and premiers, and at some point even the Prime Minister. My hope in writing the book was always, Last Woman Hanged, was always that it would be read as a letter of thanks to that generation of women who fought so hard for those rights with very little recognition. Those first steps into the political arena were tentative, but a wave rose in their wake, and it proved unstoppable. That said, I could not, in good conscience, have published the book without also trying to find Louisa's descendants. I knew as well as anyone that anybody who reads this book will want to know what happened to the children. Louisa had 10. 7 were still living when she died, the youngest of whom was only 5. May, in particular, her only daughter, what had become of her? Well, in the days before Louisa died, in an act of desperation, some of the women who were fighting for her life took May by the hand and marched all the way up to the doors of Government House and banged on the door and asked to see the governor so that May might ask for her mother's life. The governor declined to even come out to see her. He sent out his private secretary instead. It was another man. May went away in tears. One day later, she and her brothers went to see Louisa in her cell. They were taken there by Louisa's eldest son, a man whose name was Herbert. He had been working in Newcastle at the time of Louisa's trials, and he came down the Newcastle line to take the children to see their mother before she was executed. Each was permitted time to say goodbye. But what happened next? Anyone who has ever embarked on a family history project will immediately understand that the task of tracing Louisa's family was at times deeply frustrating. But I am very proud to say that some of those descendants are in the audience today. Janice and Bev Thompson, Arthur Civil and his wife Barbara, their family and their friends, welcome. Thank you for your warm embrace of this book, your kindness in allowing me to get to know your families. I want to make a special mention of Vic Kearney, great-grandson of Louisa Collins. It is such an honour to have you here today, Mr. Kearney. I've had the opportunity to meet with you once before, and I know, and I hope you don't mind me saying, that your life has at times been difficult. And I know that you spent some time as a small boy living with relatives, and that your mother sometimes had a sadness in her, and that sadness ran through your family for some years, and that you as a small boy didn't know why or what that sadness was about. And now you do. And I know that you as a young man was called upon to serve in Vietnam, and that was a searing experience for you. And I remember the line from Paul Hamm's magnificent book, "It is entirely wrong for a country to send young men to fight a war on foreign soil and then try to shame them for it upon their return." Thank you for your service, Mr. Kearney. It has been an honour to make your acquaintance, and your ancestors would be very proud of you. I would also like to thank my own mother. She's a retired school teacher. She was employed by HarperCollins to fact-check this book and to do the line editing of all the credits. She worked with her computer screen propped up on an upturned casserole dish in the spare room of their home. It has been wonderful working with you on such a special project. I know that the rights of women have been an interest of yours all your life. I understand the changes that you went through in the 1970s under Gough Whitlam and others, the free education that you received. Your approach to the women's movement has influenced me in ways that I will never forget. Thank you. And my own husband, well, I promise that I have never once been tempted to slip a little arsenic in your tea. Almost never. And my children, Michael and Chloe, my love for you knows no bounds. I realise in launching this book that it no longer belongs to me. It belongs to you, the readers. And it will, of course, be for the readers to decide whether I've made a fool of myself or not. Perhaps you will decide that Louisa Collins did indeed deserve to die on the gallows. But please, bear in mind that this is not merely the story of her hanging. It is a story about justice, about human rights, about politics. It is a story about the legal quandaries and moral questions faced by the people who work in our courts every day. And to my mind, Louisa's story is also that of a young country struggling to find a new identity at the turn of the 20th century. No longer a penal colony where convicts were thrashed in the streets, but a place where people had come to find freedom, and with that freedom, build lives of hope and happiness. It is a story of good people who failed but got back up again. It is the story of the last woman hanged at the Darlinghurst jail, but it is also the story of our shared history in the young country that we are still building together. So it is Louisa's story, but it is our story too. Thank you.
Thanks, Carolyn, and thanks to the Gallipoli Club for the use of this fine facility this evening. And so we come to questions and discussion, and we've got plenty of time. So I should remind you that a copy of Last Woman Hanged, The Terrible True Story of Louisa Collins by Carolyn Overington, is here tonight, and Janet Grundy's got some copies over there. So we come to question and discussion. First, just a factual, could just remind us how the first husband, that's Charles Andrews, how did he die, and what's the explanation for that death, of which you got acquitted? And then once you do that, I'm just going to ask you one other question and then we move on.
Yep.
Sometime late in the year 1886, Charles Andrews became ill. He complained of cramping in his stomach and he began vomiting, and he was unable to keep down any food. He was ill for a little over 7 days before he died, and at the time, there was absolutely no concern about his death. Nobody accused Louisa of murder. The idea was that he had seen the doctor in Elizabeth Street here in Sydney at least 3 times, and the doctor had no concern. He said that he believed that Charles was suffering from some sort of gastrointestinal illness, which at the turn of the century they could not really explain. He was treated with a number of different potions, but there was, of course, no penicillin. So he died from his injuries and was buried at the Rookwood Cemetery without any concern at all. It was only when Louisa's second husband, Michael, died 14 months later that the Crown decided that perhaps something was suspect. And so they went to the Rookwood Cemetery and they exhumed the body of Charles Andrews. The problem for Louisa was that when Charles Andrews' body came up, the coffin had collapsed. It was a timber coffin and the roof of it had fallen in. So it was filled with muddy water and with dirt. And Charles's body, which had already been in the ground for 14 months, had practically rotted away. His head was gone, as were most of his lower limbs. Nevertheless, they sent the chemical analyst to the laboratory with samples taken from the soil, from the water, and from what remained of Charles Andrews' corpse. And in those remains, they found what was described in the official post-mortem as a minute trace of arsenic. And that alone was added to the case against Louisa Collins. But, as a team of lawyers from Sydney said at the final trial, what does it mean to find a minute trace of arsenic in that sample taken from that soil? It was 1/1000th of a grain. There was water that was contaminated with arsenic in the area. There was soil which was contaminated with arsenic in the area. Fabrics contained arsenic in those days, as did the shroud in which he was buried. But that alone was enough to link the cases together.
Thanks. And just on the gender side of it, I mean, I think you've made a pretty good case. Certainly the jury was right on the first charge, on the first husband, possibly on the second husband. But there was a very strong case down in Melbourne of a man who was executed very quickly in the 1920s for a murder of a young girl, which he didn't commit, and he's now had an official exemption. So it wasn't just women who were wrongly trialled at the time, wasn't it? I mean, a lot of people got tough justice. So what's the gender connection here? Why, I mean, of all the people executed at Darlinghurst, there was only one woman. There must have been, what, scores of men, mustn't there?
My interest in the case, the reason I feel passionate about it, is because of the sense of injustice that it involves. If you intend to treat women as full citizens in the colony by making them pay with their lives for the crimes that they commit, then you must give them representation in the parliament. They must be entitled to a role in the way the colony is managed. You must allow them to stand for parliament so that they too can vote on capital punishment. You must allow them to vote for parliamentarians so that they too can have a say on the rules surrounding murder. You must, surely, at a minimum, have women on the jury before you can say that Louisa was tried by a jury of her peers. Many of the women who fought for Louisa, including Eliza Potty, who was one of the leading campaigners for her cause, went on to become suffragettes in the women's movement. In this book, I've been able to show, for the first time, the way women moved from Louisa's case to arguing for women's rights more generally. They went from arguing about Louisa's right to justice to arguing for the right for the vote. And they achieved it remarkably quickly. They did so, I believe, because Louisa's case was the first time that they were clearly able to argue that they were not full citizens of the colonies in which they lived, and yet when they committed crimes, they were asked to pay for their lives. Women were not flogged in New South Wales in 1889, but they were still hanged for murder. And that, for many women, was a bridge too far.
Just stay here. Just come back here. but no, not you, Carolyn, you're just popping a bit, so just come back a bit. Yes.
The juries, were they all male or were they mixed?
Questions, were the juries all male or mixed?
Yes, ma'am. It was not, women were not permitted to sit on juries in New South Wales until 1947, and even then, only in those courthouses where there was more than one bathroom was it considered permissible, because the idea that men and women might have to share facilities was considered unseemly. So the four trials, 48 jurors, 48 men. The second trial, I should say, the jury came down 11 to 1. That's how close she came to walking.
Just clarify, were there majority verdicts in the 18 and the 19?
No. It came down 11 to 1. They were unable to reach a unanimous verdict, and so another trial was held. All they needed was to get that 12th person over the line, and she would have walked.
Anne?
I believe I've been told there are judges' notes from the trials. Do they reveal any kind of attitude on his part, or how did he assess what he was listening to?
The question is, what do the judges' notes reveal?
There are four sets of judges' notes, because there were four trials, and then in addition to which there was an appeal where three of the judges sat in judgment of themselves. So they went back and decided that, yes, they would have been right all along. The judges' notebooks I found and were not revealing too much of their sentiment. They did at some point, I think I could confidently say that they took the evidence of May to be particularly compelling, because when May was on the stand and talking about the way her mother liked to drink and her mother liked to dance, and on one occasion she complained to the judge that Michael Collins had hit her with a stick of some kind, and those lines were heavily underlined in the judge's notebook, which gave me the feeling that he was taking that information particularly to heart. One of the judges was a very staunch member of the Temperance Union, and he was actually known as Water Jug, because he insisted that wine not even be used in the church. And when the evidence about Louise's drinking came up, he had underlined that evidence too, that she had been something of a drunk. And that seemed to influence him as well.
Carolyn, just stay here. Yeah. There's a question here, yes?
What does your research reveal about the quality of the defence team?
Question about what about the quality of the defence team?
Louisa Collins was given a lawyer whose name was H.H. Lusk. He would become the first lawyer in New South Wales to be struck from the role for dishonesty. He had come via New Zealand, where he had already been thrown out of the profession for accepting a bribe. And shortly after Louise's case, he was called upon to answer a charge that he had taken money for work that he subsequently hadn't completed. He declined to turn up to the hearing in front of the Chief Justice Darley, and they struck him from the role. He went on his way to New York, where he began writing fiction. He in fact wrote a book, one of the first science fiction Australian novels. It's called Eureka. And it concerns, it's too complicated to go into, but it concerns an ancient Greek city being found under Uluru and so on. It's very complicated. He also had, he was incompetent not only because he was dishonest and not only because he had a tendency to take bribes, but some of the evidence that may well have seen Louisa acquitted, for example, the idea that her husband's had been wool washers and that the arsenic in their house may well have come from the skins, or the arsenic in their system may have come from their skins, was in fact put forward by a juror. During the third trial, after things were running very badly against Louisa, a juror actually put up his hand and said, you know, isn't it possible that this came from the wool sheds? And the judge seemed quite surprised by this intervention, and he said, well, what do you mean? And the juror said, well, I work with wool all the time, and I can tell you for certain that they wash the skins with an arsenic kind of paste. And so then they called in a number of experts who testified that this was in fact the case, and the lawyer seemed quite stunned. In addition to which, in the fourth trial, one of the jurors was handed a note. Somebody walked into the courtroom and handed the juror a note. And Louisa's lawyer saw this, but didn't object. And so when it came time to the appeal judge said, well, how do we know what was in the note? The note might have said anything at all. And her lawyer said, well, I just didn't think that there was anything untoward.
Down the back, yes.
What was the public reaction after the hanging?
Question about the public reaction to the hanging.
Let me tell you first about the public reaction before the hanging. Louisa Collins was notorious. She was, at the time of her trials, the most famous woman in the colony. The case was in the newspaper day after day after day for months on end. Thousands of people turned up to watch the trials. They had long queues outside the building of people trying to get in. And everything about Louisa was described in the newspapers. The darkness of her hair, the darkness of her eyes, the material of the dress she wore, anything at all you wanted to know. There was also this idea that she was something of a strumpet, a glamorous woman, a femme fatale. Almost instantly that she was hanged, she disappears from view. It is hard to find a reference to Louisa in a newspaper, one or two, but not too many, certainly no long stories, in the week after she was hanged. And in my view, that is deliberate. I believe that what happened was that by the time they got to the fourth trial, although the evidence was not particularly compelling, the jury gave the verdict that the Crown so obviously wanted. And a frenzy had built up, a mob had formed, to get this woman and to see her hanged. The idea that women then intervened and began marching in the streets, collecting petitions, demanding that she be shown mercy, not that she be set free necessarily, but that she at least be allowed to see out her days in prison rather than put her on the gallows and hang her with small children already cognizant of the fact. But almost instantly that she died, the case went completely quiet. And all you'll find now is occasionally she pops up in a book, something like, you know, Women Who Kill or Australia's Female Killers, with everything taken as gospel, that she must be guilty, that she was a strumpet, that she had affairs with men in the street, all of it taken without any attempt to discover whether any of these things were true. I honestly believe they were ashamed of themselves.
So, where do we go? The hanging. I think you did the launch, or you had your photograph taken out of Darlinghurst Prison. Great backdrop, I'd have to say. So tell us about the hanging at Darlinghurst Prison.
I guess one of the more upsetting things about researching the book, we know that hanging was the standard response to the crime of murder from the arrival of the First Fleet. And yet, they were completely inept. They never got any better at it, not from the very first week. And Louisa's hanging, like most hangings in the colony, was bungled. I deliberately did not start the book with the hanging. In fact, one of the difficulties I've found in writing non-fiction is that I didn't get a chance to change the ending. I came to know her really well, and I came, I think, to understand her and to know a little bit about the family that she was building and the fun she was trying to have. And towards the end, I desperately wanted to save her. I wanted the women who were fighting for her to be victorious. I wanted the governor to open the door and let May in and say to her, all right, I won't send your mother to the gallows. But that's not what happened, and I knew when I started that I would have to get to the hanging. It operates as a small section of the book, right towards the end, and I've tried as much as possible to keep the language very plain and very clear. The truth of the matter is that they bungled it. The hangman at the time was a man known as Robert Howard, but he was known as Nosy Bob. He was called Nosy because he didn't have a nose. He had been kicked off by a horse. He had just two holes in the centre of his head through which he breathed. He was a grotesque-looking individual, and the hangman was the only job that he was able to get. He was a drunk. He lived in Bondi. Part of the reason he was a drunk, in his defence, was because he was treated terribly by other people in the colony. If he got on one of the horse-drawn trams, everybody else would get off. If he had a drink in one of the local bars, they would smash all the glasses. Once he went to have dinner at somebody's house and the lady of the house went and threw out all the cutlery because nobody else would touch it. all of his children, the girls, all died spinsters because nobody wanted to marry them. He turned up for the hanging of Louisa Collins with a rope that was too short. It had been so long since somebody had hanged a woman in New South Wales, almost 40 years. He didn't really know what he was doing. And although he greased the rope, you run a kind of animal fat over it so that it will run more smoothly over the beam, the drop was too short, and he almost tore her head off. Her windpipe popped out through the front of her throat, and at some point she was perpendicular. They then left her hanging for 23 minutes while blood dripped on the ground before she was finally cut down. The female wardens who had taken care of her for 6 months washed her body very tenderly, and they sent her on a train out to Rookwood. She was buried in an unmarked grave, and the benefactor was anonymous. Somebody with means paid for Louisa Collins to be placed on that train, sent to Rookwood and buried in the Church of England section. I know that the families have this week been in touch with Mike Baird, our Premier here in New South Wales, arguing that whether she was guilty or not, she deserves a tombstone. And I hope you're successful.
So the grave is known. The location of the grave is known.
Rookwood Cemetery is enormous. Those of you who have been out there will know. And the Church of England section is the most enormous part of an enormous cemetery. They know roughly the area where she was buried, but there are a lot of unmarked graves in that area. So they can't say precisely which mound belongs to Louisa. And I know that Bev and Janice have been in touch with the Rookwood Cemetery and asked for assistance in finding Louisa's grave, and they have been told that you enter at your own risk. It's very overgrown, there are snakes in that area, and it's not wise to enter. Knowing the families as I now do, I don't believe for a moment that they will take that answer as the final one.
Carolyn, stay here. Yes.
Carolyn, can you take us through how it happened? She was tried 4 times, so she was innocent. She was proven innocent, so did she go home? You know, what happened to her, and how long did the whole 4 trials take?
Which is what happened to her between the various trials.
And, you know, how did it all go?
How did it happen?
Because if you're innocent, you should go home.
Louisa was never permitted to go home. When she was arrested in July of 1888, which was the middle of the centenary year, she was taken to the Darlinghurst Jail, which still stands on Oxford Street near where the Rainbow Crossing is. It is now the National Art School, and in fact we have representatives of the art school here tonight who will be taking the families around the women's prison tomorrow, which is an amazing gift. Louisa was taken there. It surprised me. I guess I was startled to learn that she walked. I don't know how I imagined that she got there, but she lived in Botany and she walked. And it was night. It was about 6 p.m. when she was arrested. The police went into her house. About 4 or 5 of the children were clamouring for their dinner. She was drunk. Almost from the moment that Michael died, she was drunk. She started drinking instantly that he died and was wailing against the door. She constantly repeating, "Michael, Michael, please no, not Michael." Nevertheless, she continued her drinking and was drunk on the night that she was arrested. The police officer walked with her through the streets from Botany all the way to Darlinghurst, and she was remanded in prison, and there she stayed throughout the 4 trials.
And why?
It's difficult to know why. It's difficult to know why she wasn't released in between. One of the other startling aspects of the case is that her 2 youngest children, those who were aged 5 and 8, were taken into care by the state in September. So Louisa was charged in July and not executed until the following January. But they were already in state care by September. And I was able to find the entry book for them. They went to the Randwick Asylum, as it was then called, basically a children's home. And it says very clearly that the mother has been arrested and charged with the murder of her second husband. And they were placed in a kind of foster care almost immediately. So the idea that she would ever get them back seemed to have disappeared within 2 months of her arrest.
So once it was pronounced that she was not guilty, they just took her straight back into jail.
What they did was the jury was unable to return a verdict, so she was placed back in the women's cell and the next trial was called.
So was she ever found not guilty of anything? Or were there always hung juries?
They were always hung juries.
Uh-huh. Okay.
What happened to the other 5 children?
So the question is, what happened to the other 5 children?
If I tell you, will you still read the book?
Yeah.
I might have to keep some of the secrets to myself. I can tell you that I have been able to trace some of the descendants, and one of the strangest things is that on Monday of this week, because I work for the Women's Weekly, I'm the associate editor there, and the families of Louisa Collins are in the current issue of the Weekly, and another relative, unknown to me, picked up, is a regular reader of the Weekly. She said she never goes without her Weekly. She's a subscriber. She got it out of the mail. She opened it up, and she straight away recognised other members of the family that were in there. And so she's now come forward. So we now have a whole new set, which is fantastic.
Now, what I meant was you have the two youngest in a hostel arrangement. What happened to the other five at that point in
time? So the question is,
where was she
just the execution, tour and hostel arrangement, what's happened to the other five in 1889?
Herbert had already gone, the eldest had already gone north to Newcastle, and he did not come back for the trials. But the other four children spent their time in court. And at one point, one of the judges, in exasperation, said, "Who is looking after the children?" And the police, embarrassed, said, "Well, to some extent, we are." They needed to be there, of course, because May, in particular, had to testify. So they were gamboling around the courtroom throughout the trials as Louisa faced the charge of murder.
I do your deal. I always buy the Women's Weekly, but I buy two copies this month if you tell us about May, because May's born about 1880, so she could well have lived around the middle of the 20th century. So what happens to May for two copies?
Put an R on the end.
I am prepared to say that her story is not entirely bleak. She was 12 shortly after her mother was hanged. She had reached the age of 12. She was adopted into a Catholic family. And the Catholic family had 10 children. 9 of them were dead by the time May arrived. They lost an awful number in infancy, and others to various accidents around their farm. So May, I think, was a source of great joy to them when she arrived, but she didn't have an easy adolescence. It seems from one of the records that my friend Rebecca Pettit has been able to dig up, who's in the back there, that she was picked on by other people in the town, perhaps because they knew who their mother was, although I guess we don't know that for sure. But at some point her name pops up in the records that she's been the victim of a terrible assault. Another girl has come into the house and punched her in the face and left her with black eyes. I can tell you that she leaves that home, travels up the line to find her brother, who looks after her. I can tell you that one of her children was given the name Louisa.
Right, there's a question right down the back, yeah?
As part of the blurb here, you referred to a one bloody execution. I presume you mean her hanging. I am not that familiar with hanging. From my understanding, your bowels open, you defecate, you urinate.
Well, I don't think
blood involved.
Why are they bloody
executions?
So the question is, the suggestion is all executions are bloody. Why is this one particularly bloody? I think that's probably all we need to say at this stage. But well, I think it was because there was almost a decapitation. I think that's the answer.
Yeah, bloody is used in the literal sense of the word. Her windpipe popped out through the front of her throat, and it's very clear from at least 5 accounts that were given at the time, including the one in the Sydney Morning Herald, that blood dripped down from the front of the gash in her throat onto the dirt floor beneath her as she hung perpendicular. The idea of a good hanging, you're absolutely correct. The idea of a hanging is that you break the neck quickly. But there are a number of cases in this book, and you'll find other cases in this book that I've described, where the hanging was bungled. And what happens instead is that people choke to death. And then you're right, there is no blood. But so, for example, one case, the case of Michael McGee, now he was hanged in South Australia. What happened was he fired a shot at the local sheriff. He missed. The bullet grazed the sheriff on the cheek. Nonetheless, they decided that he should be hanged. The difficulty was they had no executioner and they had no place to hang him. So what they did was that they offered everybody in the town money. They said, "Will you take £5 to execute this man?" They couldn't find anybody. So then they said, "Well, will you take £10 to execute this man?" And they still couldn't find anybody. So on the day of the hanging, a great crowd had formed around the tree to see what on earth would happen. And what happened was this. A cart left the local prison, two horses, one in front of the other. On the cart, a coffin. Sitting on the coffin, the condemned man, and sitting beside him, the executioner. A man so terrified, so appalled by what he was doing, that he'd stuffed his clothes with pillows and blankets to give himself a grotesque, swollen appearance. He was wearing a mask. He painted white circles around the eyes. The idea was that nobody should know who he was. They pulled up under the tree, where they'd built a little pen, much like a sheep pen, put the noose around Michael McGee's neck, and then ordered the horse away. So instead of Michael having his neck cleanly broken, the horse wandered off. Michael slid off the coffin that he was sitting on and proceeded to hang in the air for 13 minutes while he choked to death. People in the crowd, he had his hands up the rope, desperately trying to save himself. He was calling, "Christ, please save me." Other people in the crowd were saying, "Shoot him, do something, don't let him suffer." But of course you couldn't shoot him, and so he slowly strangled to death.
Yeah, thanks for that question. down the back. So the question was, why was Louisa the last woman hanged? Did the policy to hanging females change as a result of her case?
The woman who was hanged prior to Louisa Collins was almost 40 years earlier at Goulburn Jail. She actually had an infant at the time of her execution. They allowed her to feed the infant shortly before she stepped up to the trap. And then she was hanged, the baby was taken away and died 4 months later. After that, people decided that this was really grotesque. This was really barbaric, to hang women in New South Wales when they had no other rights at all. The campaign to save Louisa changed people's minds. It changed people's minds because it was a clear example of the unfairness of the law, but also the ghastly way in which she died changed people's minds. At the time of her execution, Sir Henry Parkes, Premier here in New South Wales, known then as Prime Minister because it was before we federated, stood up in Parliament and said, "I believe the women of Australia would vote to see her hanged," which was a really audacious thing for him to say, because he knew better than anyone that women couldn't vote on anything at all. And there was an outrage, an uproar after he said those things. The opposition at the time wandered down to the town hall and had a meeting that was so large they had to keep open the doors to fit everybody in, as people argued against the idea that you could hang somebody without them having any rights at all.
I think it's a nice spot to end. Thanks, Carolyn. It's been an important night, a bit of a grim night. The good news is that next week we've just put in a topic on the important contribution to the colony of New South Wales of the Legion of Mary, just to brighten things up a bit. I'm sure it'll be booked out. But having said that, and anticipating next week, let me say thanks for tonight. Look, it's obviously a very important case and a very sad case, but I think you've presented the case for Louisa Collins much more adequately than her defence ever did. And I think it's quite a compelling account you've given tonight. Certainly, it would seem to me that a very strong case for the fact that she wasn't guilty beyond reasonable doubt, which was the only test at the time. But also, you've told us a lot about the colony of New South Wales, about the attitude of politicians, about the attitude of lawyers, and about how some people did it pretty tough. So well done tonight. I think it's a very important contribution to Australian historical understanding of late 19th century colonial Australia. You've written now, I think, about 9 books, and no doubt there'll be more to come, and no doubt you'll be back here again. But for tonight, well done, and thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.